Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2016. Lecture 26, delivered on April 28, 2016. The title of this lecture is Review for the Final Exam.
Today, review for the final exam. The final exam is 7 questions. You will answer 5 of them. Don't answer all 7 and make me work that hard for my dinner. For heaven's sakes. First things first, 3 of the questions I'll just copy and paste from exam 1 or exam 2. In other words, I've been hitting the objectives of the course as we go along, and questions that were really, this is an objective, you're going to show me at the end of the day, you got it. Whether you got it on the first or second exam, here's your chance to prove yourself to me, to show me that you know what you're doing. The other 4 are nothing way out of line. They're the same material. Possibly one of the questions that I said might be on exam 1 or exam 2 during the review for those. So there's nothing new, wildly new in the territory. Some of the questions are straight up definitions. You just tell me what I told you. Show me that you know how to reconstruct the information that has been given to you without creativity and all of that kind of stuff. Remember, we're business people. We're not creative by our nature. And then some of the questions are going to be sort of more in-depth. Show me that you can put things together to construct the appropriate answer. An upperclassman would answer the question this way. A young business professional would answer it this way. So some of them will be a little more in-depth like that. Know what I'm looking for. You did a lot better on exam 2 as far as your grammar and your spelling and all of that. Keep that up. Stay frosty. Honestly, you should be able to answer the questions, the 5 that you've chosen, within about 30 minutes. And then you have plenty of time to go back through and make sure that you did everything right. You spelled, you punctuated and all that, and that you didn't leave out a critical word along the way that I have to figure out what you meant. So you're going to have plenty of time to do the exam. It's not going to be like a pressure cooker for you that way. The pressure cooker is for you to just show me that you're able to, at the end of the day, to do this material so you can move on with your lives and never see finance again for most of you. I hope. No. I do encourage you. Well, no, I don't. Finance is a field that just can't get moving. We can't. There's still the corruption in there. Even researchers are now finding that the way people think, even when they're not doing finance, if you're in the finance industry, you still have this mindset that I got to do things this way that's not the right way. And of course, I've mentioned there's the sexism that is just a terrible problem, and it's kind of frustrating. Maybe you're the generation that's going to turn it around. Then again, maybe not. You got a hard road in front of you, folks, so I don't want to put the burden on you anymore. Listen, I'm going to give you some things that I think you need to know. Things that I would suggest, topics for studying. And then you ask me straight up, is this going to be on the exam? And I'll say, no, that's not. Or, that could be. But if it's not going to be there, I'm going to be dead straight with you. The class yesterday, 4 questions. Is this going to be on the exam? No. And of course, they tear up that part of their notes and throw it out the window. But that's a good thing, is if you ask me, I can tell you, no, that's not. Okay, start with a question that's kind of important, not kind of important, it is very important. In financial analysis, and in your analysis of numbers, You need to know the difference between accounting and finance in terms of cost and in terms of profit. Show me that you know what an accountant considers to be a cost and what a finance person, a financial analyst, or what you in your personal lives would be consider a cost. Sometimes they're the same, but in a lot of cases, what are the costs that we consider important in finance that are not even in the accounting financial statements? And how does that impact on the word profit as an accountant would use it, as opposed to a business person or a financial analyst would use it? Sometimes it amazes me, because when I've prepared my taxes for my company, all they want are those accounting numbers. And it's like I literally every year I look at this isn't what happened. This is not what happened. And it's even more important, this is not what's going to happen. So that's a hint. Costs, know the costs that are important in finance. Know how those differ from costs that are important in accounting. And I went through this, so, well, let me, do you have one of those costs that you know of right off the bat that we care deeply about? Even in our day-to-day lives, that's nowhere in the accounting statements anywhere. What do we call that? The opportunity cost. It is absolutely drives decision making, and it is nowhere in financial statements prepared for by accountants. That is not to say that accountants are the evil empire or anything like that. Well, maybe they are. No. It says that they have to follow these strict rule-based systems, generally accepted accounting principles, consistently applied, and all that, but that's not going to determine what we do. It's certainly not the business decision. There are other costs that we care about in finance that accountants don't care about. There are costs that accountants care about that we just are not really all that. We have to use their numbers, but we have to start thinking, well, how do we modify these so that they mean something to us? Answer that question and you will really impress me.
A lot of
say that, yeah. Listen, when I've spent $4,000 for a new piece of equipment, and I cannot write, I spent $4,000, I just spent $4,000 on my financial statements, on my income statement, and I cannot report to the IRS, I just blew $4,000. So in other words, my costs are lower when I report accounting-wise to the IRS, which means my profit is higher, which means I get smacked around with taxes harder, because I can't say I spent $4,000. Oh, no, you can't do that. You must capitalize that and then depreciate it off over a period of 4 years. You know, folks, I'll be dead in 4 years. Give me a break. You know, I'm old. So absolutely, those kinds of costs, things like that. And the opportunity costs. And there are a couple of others that I talked about too. Okay, so now let me get down to some basics. You got to know about bonds. Specifically, I could ask you a question. What is the relationship between the term of a bond and the bond's price? I asked this before, and I want you to show me that you get it this time. And I could ask it in the same question. I might create a double part to it. What is the relationship between the coupon? What is the relationship between the spread between coupon and yield and the price? What is the relationship between the spread between coupon and yield and the price? What is the relationship between the spread between coupon and yield and the price of the bond? Now remember that it's, you can't just say this if the spread is, you have to say the spread, if the coupon is above the yield, the price is this. If the spread, if the coupon is below the yield, then the coupon price is this. You can't say a number, but you can say where it is relative to a very important place in bonds. What is the pivot price of a bond? Do you know? Do you know what is the pivot? Do you know what the pivot price of a bond is? Do you remember? I never asked you this directly, but it was always there as subtext.
Par.
Exactly. That $1,000, 100 is the quote. That is the pivot. So when you're describing this, if the spread, if the coupon is above the yield, you could describe its relationship to par. If this coupon is below the yield, you could then explain there the relationship, price of the bond relative to par. Okay? Make sure you know how to do it that way. Stay frosty. Answer my questions crisply. Don't beat around the bush at all on me. You'll make me happy because I have a lot of great exams to grade. But at the same time, I have a full pot of coffee and three cats to sit with me while I'm grading. They tend to sit a little ways away usually because I start growling. You need to know about risk, okay? Specifically, I have just ranted and raged about the difference between diversifiable and non-diversifiable risk. Risk means really not a whole lot. Yeah, I just split my head open and now I'm not very bright because I was driving my motorcycle, man. Yeah, were you wearing a helmet? Oh, no, man. Well, my violin for you just went from a viola down to a toy, you see. Because you had risk that you could have avoided. You didn't need to take that risk, but you chose to. So keep in mind that difference. Why is that important to us? And then some very basic, straight-up standard, just give me the answer in no more than 12 words usually. What is beta? What is beta measure? Why do we not care about price volatility in and of itself, but we do care about beta? Now, a question that this is good bait. I'm not saying it'll be there, but it's something that would be important for. Look, I give you a lot of theory in this class, but I try not to waste your time. But one question that you can take past this class to your own lives, maybe not to any other course here, but surely to your own lives. Give me three features of a quote-unquote good portfolio. Give me three features of a good portfolio. And no, the portfolio should have a lot of stocks with cool-sounding ticker symbols. Or this portfolio should have a lot of stocks that my friend Lonnie down at the Fort Jesse Cafe told me to buy. Those are not good answers, okay? But you know very well, features of the portfolio. Size, remember the correlation thing? Remember the beta must be like you? I asked this question and you kind of looked at me like blankly, and I understand why you did at the time, but we do encourage you to start answering this thing about what is your beta? Because you know it now, and then you can start to track your beta through time. It's rather disturbing because your beta might be here, and honestly, 1.4, and then later in your life you realize, oh my God, how I'm getting old, my beta's 0.8. On that side, it might make you feel old before your time, but get that idea of what is your beta. And your portfolio, you shouldn't just slap together a portfolio. Think about what your tolerance for risk is. Interestingly, most, and I said this before, most young people see their tolerance for risk as higher than it actually is from their behaviors. But also, interestingly enough, on the other side, we see financial planners will look at people who are older and their portfolios are defensive before they need to be. We'll see in their late 40s, people who have crafted their own portfolios that are in the 0.6, 0.7 range, and they're really not old enough to be way down there. That's like getting closer to retirement kind of thing. But anyway, I might very well ask you to tell me what the features, three features of a good portfolio. Be specific. One or two sentences is all you're going to need for any of these answers, and that's one of those short ones. And it's something that's important in your lives, too. Okay. I'm going to ask you about interest rates on a couple of different levels. I could ask you about the risk premium, or what are the components of an interest rate. Remember, there's that risk-free rate, and then there's the risk premium. Ask you to lay out each of the components of the risk premium is. The default premium, there's the default premium, which is the reward for the possibility part or all of the cash flow won't be satisfied. And there is, you know, one long sentence like that. Or I could again ask you about what is the risk-free rate and that kind of thing. In a similar vein, I could the CAPM, I'm going to bring it up. One good question is to ask you, how would an actual financial analyst or finance professional or a project manager even use the capital asset pricing model? This is not a diffuse question. It might sound like this is an all over the place, several bunch of different answers. It's fuzzy. No, this is not. Ask yourself, what do we calculate with the CAPM? What is the CAPM for? What is on the left side of that equation? And what do we use that result to do? You hit me right over the head, metaphorically, not with, with what do we do with it? Otherwise, it's just an abstract thing that I've just fatigued you with. But if you know the actual, okay, we calculate something with this. What do we use that something for? The CAPM is just nothing in and of itself. Okay. I'm going to ask you about equity. Equity, I'll find one of these to bring up. On the one hand, what are the two kinds of equity? Remember that the shareholders have equity. If there's any profit in a financial economic sense, that's internally generated equity. And then there's that other kind of equity. And a related question, who has the prior claim and who has the residual claim on cash flows of a company? And what does this mean about the relative costs of the capital from them? Who has the prior claim and who has the residual claim? And what does this mean about the relative costs of capital of them? That's a classic. I'm not going to tell you this is going to be on the exam, but it could be on the exam. Well, that was vague as heck. Okay, a couple of other gimmies. This straight up, don't beat around the bush with questions like this. Okay, what is the relationship between net present value and internal rate of return? Okay. Yeah. Some of you, well, I tried, but just hit it over the head. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that, I'm not going to say anymore. Okay, a little bit more questions that are address larger things. For example, what is money? And what are the three types? Now remember, when I ask about the three types, you don't say M1, M2, M3. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about in terms of intrinsic value. What is money? And this is actually something that's important for you because you're going to run into a world where remember what I called the kind of money that's, we've never seen it before in history and suddenly it's here now? You remember what I mentioned about that? You guys are living in the world where there's a kind of money that has never existed in history. The other three kinds of money have been here all along. Every one of them. Well, yeah, about every one of them. Well, maybe in the Paleolithic they didn't have fiat money, but there's a new kind of money now that's out there. You don't have to bring it up. I won't take off if you don't mention this one. But you remember what I call this new money that exists now that hasn't ever existed in history before? What is it? Cryptocurrencies, the cryptos. And I mean, they keep trying to destroy them. Government bodies do, and the media declares they're all gone now. No, they're not. They can't go away now. They're becoming embedded in the web, especially in the deep web. Okay. Another one that would be in that. I'll try to throw out one or two that are just definitional. I could ask, what is flight to quality? Flight to quality. You remember flight to quality? From stocks to bonds, from bonds to... Now, you don't answer the question that way. You explain it in dignified terms, for heaven's sakes. We're all civilized people here. Yeah. But you remember that thing right there, this is something that can happen. It happens realistically as an investor. You should actually kind of keep an eye. If they're flight to quality, it doesn't mean one day stocks are sold and everyone buys bonds. That's not really flight to quality. It would be a longer term thing. But in your lifetimes, I'm sure you will see real flights to quality. I hope they never get to the point where the flight makes it to the bullets. But maybe it will. Okay, another one. What is liquidity? And how is liquidity related to return on investment? And I'll give you a little further explanation of that. Okay. You have, sir, $100,000. You keep it all in your pocket. Now, would that mean you're highly liquid or highly illiquid? Huh? Yeah, you're not just highly liquid. You're a waterfall. Blah, 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 blah. You know, you're a babbling brook. Okay, so that means that at any time, you can grab a burger at Steak and Shake, right? I recommend the Royal Burger. It is awesome. It's got the double cheeseburger and then the fried egg on top, except it's kind of like this heart bypass they keep talking about. It bothers me after I eat five or six of those. Okay, but that's liquidity. What else could you be doing with that? What else could you have done with that money? Instead of keeping it in your pocket, what could you have done with it?
Put it in the safe.
Yeah. Now, did you earn anything by keeping it in your pocket?
No.
But that's that trade-off. Liquidity, companies that keep very high liquidity, yeah, they can pay their bills rapidly, they can make decisions very quickly, but at the same time, they don't have that depth of return on their investment. They aren't able to earn. If they put it in a bank account, they could earn a little bit. If they put it into an asset in a factory, they could earn a lot. So in other words, as you lose liquidity, you gain return. And this is, interestingly enough, something that we just didn't understand. A generation ago, we were so enamored with this system that the Japanese manufacturers used called just-in-time. where they didn't keep an inventory of stuff on their shelves, doors for cars and bumpers for the cars and all that. They would have order it, and they would have a little factory that made it when they needed it just in time. That's wonderful. That's liquidity. But at the same time, what that meant was that if there was suddenly a surge in orders, you backlogged, you were sunk. If there was suddenly an explosion at that little factory, you were dead because you didn't have anything on your shelves besides what was there in that factory. You see the trade-off? It plays out all through the business, our business lives, and even in our personal lives. For you yourself, you could have $17 in your pocket. 17. Now, that's very, very good. But that makes you have credibility. You go home to your wife and kids, I've got $17. And you're down with them for the night. But then when the kid says, I need to go to college, and you say, you're on your own, sucker. So the kid instead gets a bunch of tats and piercings and goes off and lives in a hippie commune. Okay, I want you to know, I talked about why that you should have at least some suspicion when a company has an offering of common stock. I could ask you about that. Why should you be suspicious when a company offers common stock? There are a couple of reasons I went through on that. You remember one of them, and I'll tell you one of them was, well, I'm always suspicious when a successful person who says he's successful wants to share his success with me. I really, really am suspicious of that. And it's not just because I'm a cynical old bastard. Well, I am, but there's just a logic that's not there when someone says, out of the goodness of my heart, I'm going to tell you the secrets of how I made my fortune. No. Okay, why are interest rates important in business investment decision making? Why do we as business people care about where interest rates are going? Think about what we use interest rates to determine. Our whole lives as business people are yeses and nos. It's kind of grim to think about it this way, but we are all binary. Yes to this project. No to that supplier. Yes to this employee. Okay, actually, no to that employee. Think about everything that we do in decision making and how I showed you it's done in the business world. Why do we care so much about where interest rates are headed? Okay, I could ask you about that. Now, also, I'm not sure, but I spent time talking about the Federal Reserve. Now, two different approaches I could say. What are the three duties of the Federal Reserve? Or I could say, what are the three tools of monetary policy the Federal Reserve has? So I could ask, was that a sneeze or not? And don't confuse these two. What are the three duties of the Federal Reserve? Remember, the Federal Reserve is kind of always thought of as the money controls the money supply. Now, that's just one of its duties. It has three different duties. And I brought up this one thing, interestingly. You remember I talked about one of those things that the Federal Reserve, hardly anyone in the country knows it does it. It does it phenomenally well, and it competes against private banks that do the same thing, and it doesn't destroy the private banks. It's an incredibly strong, technologically incredible system. That's one of those other duties that hardly anyone ever knows about the Federal Reserve. Yes, the Federal Reserve might be the evil empire of the universe, but it does have things it does besides doing evil. Most people don't know that when Darth Vader isn't destroying planets and everyone on them, he actually does charitable events for certain organizations.
Okay. The heck with you. Okay. Let me see. Did I get there?
Oh, yeah. What's optimal capital structure? And why does it matter? That's actually just a question for the second exam. I could ask you about the yield curve again. Make sure you know the difference between a healthy and an unhealthy yield curve. And again, like I said, I know a lot of people who are finance types, economics types. They obsess on the yield curve. They look at it every morning and then at the end of every day. You don't have to do that, but I do like to know that you have that skill set where you can look at the yield curve and just every once in a while and say, that's okay, or that bothers me. It's along that line where if you're my friend, you're my bro, okay? And most days you look really good, and I don't see you every day, but I see you once in a while. Your complexion is nice, you comb your hair, you wear a nice shirt and all of that. But then there's that one day when you've got nodules, and clearly you were chewing on human flesh, and you're very thin, and matter of fact, your flesh is kind of rotting off, and you smell like you were in a grave. Well, I worry. I'm that kind of guy. You understand? What that had to do with finance, I don't know, but and that's the thing. Just know why a yield curve could look unhealthy. Remember, and it's not so much that, this is a perfect yield curve. But when you see a yield curve that does that, that's a problem. Or if you see a yield curve that does that, well, that's moved to New Zealand or something like that. And if you ever see a yield curve do that, well, see if that private company, Elon Musk's company, has an extra seat on a flight to Mars. Okay. Just some friendly advice. Your turn. Ask me questions. Maybe I missed something. Or maybe you'd like me to zero in just to make sure that you shouldn't study for something. What do you got for me? Anything at all? Yeah, go ahead.
Anything about stock screens?
No. I really would love to, but I mean, that's just like, you get into the, I really would like to, but you do at least know where to find them and how to look at them. Good question, though. Excellent question. Because I did ask something about that on the one exam. So now don't worry about that. What else? Anything? Yeah.
You can ask about leverage.
No. Nope. Yeah.
You can ask about basic financial ratios.
No, I'm not. There are ways that I could ask questions like that, but you've got to get into some really deep stuff. I could ask, why is a liquidity ratio that's too high as bad as a liquidity ratio that's too low, or something like that. But you can get into some answers where that's almost a little higher level course than I want you to be able to get at this point, honestly. And being completely honest, there was a time when I was really butch and I would ask that in a 240 class, and then I'd find that my Goodyear tires had been slashed. Yeah.
Can you ask about surplus?
No. What did that have to do with? You remember the term that I was asking that about?
Financial intermediation.
Intermediation, that's right. Now ask me, will I cover ask about financial intermediation on the exam? No. So you get benefit out of this because I did ask it. And now you know that I'm not going to revisit it. That narrows down the number of questions from the one in exams 1 and 2 that I would be pulling. Anything else you got? You've hit a couple. Go.
Are you going to ask us about the data from the different industries?
No. I will ask you to show me that you know what beta is. It's the second letter of the Greek alphabet. No, yes, that's fine, but that's not what I care about. Yeah, go ahead.
Ask about loans.
Huh?
Ask about loans, like from the issuer to the seller.
Oh, I surely wish I could have. I had thought to do that, but I didn't. No. Well, who's the issuer? Who's the purchaser? Yeah, go ahead.
Are you going to ask about the 2 exemptions?
No. That's really at the edge of what I would ask in a class like this. And I'm not the final exam is more center of the course. That's on one of those peripheries out there. Yeah. The bond prices, yes, as far as I would ask you, okay, if the what is the relationship between a bond price and the term of the bond, in other words, how long it has to maturity, just like I asked on one exam. And the other side of that was, as I said, what's the relationship between the spread between coupon and yield and the price of a bond? What is the relationship between the spread and yield of a bond and the price of the bond? Go. Oh, yeah. In spades, I guarantee you, I will ask somehow about systematic versus unsystematic risk. One of those fundamentals of the course that carries with you. Go. No, no. Good question. That is brutal material. That's something that I will beat you up with on a midterm. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's one of those things where you ask something once and people are stunned by it, and then they walk away, well, that was mean. If I do it again, that's when you start putting C4 underneath my car. Not enough to kill me, but enough to at least certainly tune up the car, and it needs a tune-up really badly now. Since last year, I haven't done it. What else? Yeah. Well, say that again. I just didn't hear quite catch the last of it. Oh, I see. I didn't ask that. I've written the exam. I mean, I can post it online if you'd like, but I didn't ask that. Yeah. Go for it, teacher. No, remember the different benchmarks? There was the LIBOR, then there's the Treasury bills, and then there's the prime bank rate. I won't ask that on the final. That's a good question, though, but it's not one I caught. Yeah.
We saw a lot of
no-card. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Go.
Distinguish between debt and equity.
I kind of already told you that question, right? Had to do with that prior thing. Go. Oh, no, actually, the final exam, I got to put this up online for you. I didn't realize it wasn't there. The final exam for this class is Wednesday, next week, a week from yesterday, from 3:10 to 5:10. And all you're going to need for it, you got your note card, your pencil or your pen, and a whole lot of motivation not to ever have to take this course again. Elvis has left the building.